Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. We've had a lot of fun doing the podcast in the last several weeks, but this week we're getting back to the root of what I really like in a lot of the podcasts, and that's talking about visual effects in feature films. And of course, this Friday in the States, the Wolfgang Petersen-directed film Poseidon opens up, and that's obviously a huge visual effects film. It's a remake of the 1972 classic The Poseidon Adventure. But a lot of the work in the remake of The Poseidon was done by ILM. So to that end, Mike Seymour is going to be talking with Moen Leo, who's an associate visual effects supervisor for ILM. And they're going to be covering a lot of the fluid dynamics for the film, because obviously water plays a huge role. I mean, some might even consider it a supporting actor role in the movie as well. So that was a really, really critical aspect of the film. So why don't we pick up that conversation Mike Seymour had with Moen Leo about Poseidon. Mike?
Thanks for that, John. And Moen, thank you for joining us on the line from ILM. How are you?
Hi. I'm good, thank you.
So the film industry is obviously one of having worked and building a reputation and people that you know, and this project must have been good for you because you're working with Kim, who you'd worked with at The Matrix, correct?
That's correct, yeah. I've worked with Kim for a number of years now on the two Matrix sequels, as well as Catwoman and Herbie. And so this was my fifth project with Kim.
And your position on Poseidon?
I was the associate visual effects supervisor for ILM.
So this was a fairly big film by most standards, but I don't know, how does it rate in terms of ILM? Because obviously you're well set up to handle the biggest films that are done.
Right. The number of shots we did wasn't that large compared to many other projects that ILM does. I think we had a total of about 150 shots. But the difference with this project was that frequently, when you have a big show, you have a lot of sort of not throwaway shots, but easy shots, and then a smaller number of hero shots. Poseidon was really a show where the work that they gave to ILM, about half of it on any other show would have counted as hero shots. They were really big, very complex, all CG shots. So we had, you know, 3-4 dozen of very, very hard shots that really required top-level talent and really hardcore technology to do them.
So we'll discuss those in one second. Wolfgang Petersen was directing this, and he has a tradition of doing stuff with the ocean and with water from his Dust Boot, which was a brilliant film, and then, of course, Perfect Storm at ILM. I was just curious, when Perfect Storm came out, I remember hearing at the time that there were some issues about balancing realism with movie making. In other words, when you're doing a lot of this work with things like waves and oceans and stuff, there's simulation work that's done, but of course you're actually in the business of making films. How much did you have to balance those two things, filmmaking and real life simulation?
That definitely turned out to be a challenge for us because on the one hand, of course, you want to create realistic images, realistic motion. On the other hand, you have to tell a story and you have to have exciting shots that are visually impressive and that, you know, frequently bend the rules of the laws of physics and frequently break them. So we frequently had to either augment our simulations or even in some cases abandon simulation as an approach and really use artistic tools for some shots just to be able to get something that in real life wouldn't happen but that on the screen is just, you know, what the director wanted to see and what was the most impressive for the shot.
Would it be fair to say your shots broke down into what you might call normal visual effects shots and then the water simulation shots?
There probably wasn't a really clear distinction there. I mean, there were a number of what you would call normal visual effects shots that were just background extensions of ocean or, you know, shots of the exterior of the ship that were extended. But then we had certainly some shots that were fully simulated, where every part of it was run through a really advanced fluid dynamics solver to get the most realistic motion. And then we had some hybrid shots where we wanted to get the interaction with the ship to be as realistic as possible, but then at the same time, the director and Boyd Schirmes, the studio visual effects supervisor, had very specific ideas of what the wave should look like, what the shape and height of the wave should be, how it should move. So we would use artistic means sculpting the wave body itself, but then running simulations for the areas where that wave interacted with the ship.
Just before we get to the simulation section, on the what I was, I guess, stupidly calling the normal visual effect shots, but these very big effect shots that you were doing that didn't require simulation, one of the ones that's incredibly impressive is that opening section from below the water coming up on the ship and the jogger. Could you explain that shot for us?
Right. That shot is basically the entire title sequence of the movie. Is a 4,500 frame long shot, continuous shot of the camera starting underwater, looking up at the ocean surface, and then the ship comes in, and as the ship goes over the camera comes out of the water and then flies around the ship, moving in very close to a jogger, which is the main character played by Josh Lucas, up to like within 5 feet of him, then swooping out again, showing us the rest of the ship, and in the end it finds him again on the top deck of the ship and goes in very close on him, and then pans out to the ocean. So we really, within one shot, had to show the ship from underwater, from above water, like every part of it, you know, the flying all around and showing all the different parts of the ship, but then at the same time come in very close, come within like 5 feet of, you know, the deck and the railings and all the pieces of furniture that are on it. So it was an incredibly complex shot, both technically in terms of the rendering and the amount of geometry and all that, but also in the planning phase, because the only thing real in the shot is Josh Lucas, shot on a green screen with a cable cam in two sections, and it took a great amount of planning. One of our layout artists, Colin Benoit, and I spent a lot of time planning that, first in the computer and then working with cable cam for like 4 days, setting up the shoot, just making sure that motion really worked and would fit in, and the connection between the runner and the ship would be seamless. And one of the other things that turned out to be really challenging in that shot is the amount of detail we had to put into it. And in the end, our ship ended up being made up out of, I think, 6,500 props, you know, deck chairs and lamps and pieces of railing and, you know, newspapers and towels and all these things that make the ship, you know, look alive and look like a really populated little city. So that took a massive effort in terms of the asset handling, the level of detail handling in the rendering, because even with our proprietary software, it wasn't possible to load in all that detail at the render quality resolution into a scene. So Vincent Toscano developed a asset management tool that allowed us to basically have the ship set up in a modular way, where we had all these little components, many of which would be repeated but then had variations in terms of paint or geometry variations and different levels of detail depending on how close you were to them in a particular shot. So that in the end the ship was made up out of 180,000 roughly pieces of geometry, but a lot of those would only be brought in at render time, so that when you were working with it interactively, it basically was a much more bare bones structure that allowed interactive work with it.
Yeah, sounds amazing. I mean, the specs on the ship, if it was real, was that it's, what, a 20-story high, I think I read somewhere 1,100 feet long, 4,000 crew ship, correct?
Right. It was basically roughly based on the Queen Mary 2, which is about like 1,100 feet. I think ours was a little bit longer. But they wanted to have a more sleek, modern design on it. So the general specs, the size and width of it were based on the Queen Mary II, but the Warner Brothers art department came up with a fairly different design. So since the ship basically was something that could not, does not exist in real life, it had to be completely generated in the computer.
So having happily watched and remembered watching the original 72 Poseidon Adventure, I guess I'm giving nothing away to say that you're going to take that liner and hit it with a 150-foot wall of water.
Right.
So can I ask you then, there are a lot of water effects rather than just the one wave hitting the ship, but, you know, what would be the main aspects of the fluids or the water simulation that you had to do that was the most challenging thing about this project?
I think there were a number of different challenges. First of all, the sequence, which in the original movie, the ship being hit by the wave and turning over is pretty much one shot. Here it's stretched out over like a 2 or 3 minute sequence made up of like dozens of shots showing different parts of the ship being hit and flooded and destruction on the ship. Then also seeing from underwater as the ship turns upside down. So there were really a number of different effects in terms of the interaction of the ship with the water, having big white water splashes, dealing with underwater bubbles that are churned up, foam on the surface, all these things, and having all these interact properly and move with each other so they really feel like it's one body of water.
So as I understand it correctly, the fluid dynamics that you were using really pushed the envelope in terms of the reaction or interaction between the CG waves and the hard body objects that are happening. In other words, as the water hits the ship and as it hits around objects and stuff, you achieve new levels of realism for simulating that kind of interaction.
Yeah, I think for a great number of shots, we were able to really simulate every part of that water interaction from using a proprietary fluid dynamics solver that Stanford developed in cooperation with ILM. And it's a full volumetric 3D fluid solver that runs a fluid simulation on a regular volumetric grid using the particle level set approach that Fedke and Enright published papers on over the last few years. And it's basically a hybrid approach that uses both the surface and two layers of particles sandwiching that surface to get an accurate fluid simulation and at the same time getting very good mass conservation and volume conservation.
See, I was wondering about that because the work that I think you just mentioned then, the Fred Koo stuff at Stanford University has the... the physics-based modeling stuff they call FISBAM, and that went into your Xeno infrastructure, is that correct?
That's correct. ILM uses a proprietary software package called Xeno, and the great thing about a relationship with Stanford is that we really get their latest research within days implemented in our software, and those guys from Stanford are up here at least twice a week. Towards the end of the show, we had two PhD students work full-time on Poseidon, running simulations, updating the fluid solver, and it's really great. I mean, without their contributions, we would not have been able to do this because the complexity and the accuracy of the Stanford fluid solver really surpasses anything available in commercial packages so far. So it's also... it also allowed us to run simulations at resolutions that before this project were absolutely not achievable to a large degree because Stanford managed to parallelize the code so that we could run multi-proc simulations that really allowed us to capture a great amount of detail in a reasonable time. Early on in the project, we ran tests and when you're running simulations at low resolutions, there are a number of problems with that. First of all, the fluid simulations tend to behave much more viscous than real water, and only when you go to the higher resolutions you really get the water-like behavior. Beyond that, also, they don't scale in a lower res simulation, get a particular result you like, and then simply up res it and hope to get the same thing just with more detail. It doesn't really work that way. So you really, in order to have realistic water behavior, you have to run fairly high resolution simulations, which early on when we ran these tests could take like 3-4 days just to get a single take for a shot, which just wasn't practical. So when Stanford managed to allow us to run these on multiple processors, and we could run them on like 8 or 16 processors in parallel, that really allowed us to get the kind of realism that we wanted, and at the same time turn these simulations around overnight, which was really important.
So there are some issues you touched on there I'd like to follow up. I mean, firstly is the issue of scale. One of the things from a physical model's point of view that you try and do when scaling water, apart from obviously shooting at a high frame rate, is micro surface texture, because the surface micro texture really is a good indicator of scale. And to that end, I guess I'd say, was it really a matter of dealing with surface properties and sort of fluid movement as two separate things to get all those sort of details that really sell the waves?
Well, one of the great things about the PLS approach is that you don't just get the fluid surface out of it, but in areas that are very dynamic, the particles that surround the surface become ejected, and so the particles that come from the below the water surface, if they get sort of flung into the air violently, they detach from the fluid surface, and you can use these particles to represent spray particles. In return, you can do the same thing with that other layer of particles. If they get sucked underwater, you can use them to represent bubbles. And if you run your simulations at a high enough resolution, the areas in which this occurs really visually match the areas where in real life the surface tension of the water breaks down and water becomes spray or air becomes bubbles, so that out of the fluid simulation, you don't just get the surface detail, you get appropriate spray particles, you get appropriate bubble particles that you can then also run through the fluid flow so the bubbles are moved around with the fluid. You can test for the spray particles hitting the surface again, and same with bubbles rising to the surface and emit foam particles in appropriate areas, so that you then really have a unified system of water surface, spray particles, underwater bubbles, and foam particles that are all based on the same fluid sim that really move together and that really, you know, make it feel like a complex system where everything matches and where the different parts influence each other appropriately.
So am I right in thinking that basically at the fluid dynamic level, you've got energy conservation and volume conservation stuff with eigenvalues and eigenvectors and stuff that are then spawning the particle stuff, but what you're saying is that is all incorporated in one complete unified system, is that correct?
Yes, I mean, to the extent that you really get the surface turned into spray in areas that are appropriate, that where you would expect the water to actually be atomized and become little droplets of water,
like splatter when it hits like the water hits a irregular object, for example.
Yeah, correct. I mean, basically, even little waves, like if you have two waves lapping up against each other and they basically splash up, you would get particles, you know, ejected in the right areas. And that was something that early on, really, even though this was very cutting edge and the technology that hadn't really been used on this scale before, just looking at these qualities of the simulations and seeing that we would get not just, you know, the shape of the wave, but we would get particle emission in the right places, was a really important reason for us to choose this approach.
One part of FEDCU's research that interests me was what I think they call vorticity, which is, you know, confinement vortex type spin stuff. Was that controllable, or was that just a natural occurring phenomenon in the simulation?
Early on, we ran simulations where you just had an overall vorticity confinement that would basically counteract the tendency of these fluid simulations to, in a way, dissipate vortices and eddies and swirls. They just, in these simulations, naturally kind of die out. And the vorticity confinement globally looks for these areas of high vorticity and amplifies that. That turned out to be a little bit difficult to control, and so what they added was a different level of control, which they also published a paper on last year, called spin particles or vortex particles, that allowed us to inject into the fluid simulations particles that would locally increase the vorticity. And so areas that we wanted to be more turbulent and swirly, we could just put these spin particles in there, and they have a radius and a strength, and they would locally create eddies, or rather amplify existing eddies.
And so was that one of the areas that you referred to about addressing it looking too viscous, creating these eddies and localized phenomenon?
The spin particles definitely help in adding visual detail and making the fluid look more thinner in a way, or less viscous. The other thing is really just the speed and shape with which the fluid moves. If you run lower simulations, it really more resembles honey than water, and only once you get to a certain resolution it becomes sort of thin enough that it really becomes splashy and has a lot of detail. But yes, absolutely, visually, the increasing the vorticity and having the ability to locally increase the vorticity allowed us to give it much more visual detail, which makes it look much more water-like.
So coming back now to the filmmaking side of things, when you ran the simulations, that's solving, obviously, at a very complex level what the fluids are doing. You still have to light that, though. You still have to put that into the scene. How integrated was this with your shaders and renderers, and could you explain how that worked?
Sure. Early on, we made the decision to render the ship in mantle ray, mainly because we felt that with the global illumination technique and the full refractions and reflections and all the really complex lighting that we wanted to do, mantle ray was the better option, the more tested way to do that level of ray tracing. And initially we had attempted to render the water surface as an implicit surface through mantle ray. A little bit down the line, a few months into it, we looked at that again, and mainly because we decided to render the particles through RenderMan, because particle rendering, on the other hand, is a lot easier to do in RenderMan, we abandoned the implicit surface approach, and one of our CG supervisors, Willy Geiger, wrote a tessellator that took the implicit surface from the fluid simulation, would also integrate some of the particles that are around the water surface, which added further detail, and basically tessellate these into a geometry mesh that would be passed to RenderMan and rendered. And for the most part, we did some ray tracing there in order to have the spray be reflected in the water and the ship be reflected in the water. But for the most part, it was just used as a faster way to render the water surface, and also to have better integration with the particles, because one of the things we wanted to do with the particle rendering was to really capture the internal glow that large volumes of white water have.
I was going to say, that's the thing that really struck me, is just the quality of the depth of the water. It just wasn't a surface solution. There's like an enormous depth to the water in this.
Right, so we did a number of things. There's for the underwater bubbles, we used volumetric shaders to give that cloud-like look of churned up water, the sort of green swirly look that you get underwater. But then for the white water that is airborne and splashes, we implemented a multiple scattering approach that would basically bake light information onto a point cloud, and use that in the beauty renders to really get the sense that when you shine light through big splashes of white water, like you have in fountains or something, the water starts to glow from within, and the light is scattered around. And it really is it's a beautiful effect that the visual effects supervisor on the Warner Brothers side very much wanted to see, and he was very happy that we were able to do that.
Is that related to like a subsurface scattering type algorithm?
It's a approach, yes. Initially, we even used some of the subsurface scattering code that exists in RenderMan, and then eventually it got to a point where we were limited by what was there and replaced that with our own code.
So, and then how about the levels of realism that we discussed earlier? Having done all this beautiful work, how much was it needing to be dramatically revised, not because it was inaccurate, but because it just didn't work the story hard enough?
There were certainly instances in the beginning of the movie where the giant wave approaches the ship where we tried to cheat our simulations to the point where they would match the previous that had been done, and it turned out to just be impossible because in reality a 200-foot wave would not really sustain itself for minutes, and it would either break or dissipate, and it would certainly not take 2 or 3 minutes to overwhelm a ship, you know. They really wanted to milk this dramatic sequence, so that turned out to be a little bit of a challenge there, and in a lot of cases, as I mentioned before, we would take a hybrid approach and simulate the areas of interaction with the ship where we really wanted to get the maximum realism, but then at the same time use artistic means to define the shape of the wave to really get the shot and the composition that the director was looking for. For the second half of the movie, or rather the very end, where there's a sequence where the ship finally sinks, there it wasn't so much about art directing the shape of the water, but what the ship was doing, and we just needed the water to react appropriately and realistically. And there it turned out that it was very straightforward to run these simulations, and they would give us really beautiful results. And in a couple of instances, the Boyd Shermis even reframed certain shots just to really capture the interesting fluid simulations that the solver would give us.
Ironically, since the 72 film was originally made, satellite imaging has determined that large freak waves actually do occur, which is kind of ironic. But but just going on the eyewitness accounts for the tsunami in the Asia region around a year or so ago, there was an enormous lessening of water levels as the water was sucked into the waves before they finally hit. I was wondering, in the build-up to the first hit of the first big wave, were you looking at doing anything to indicate that kind of sucking into the wave, the... Do you know what I'm saying? The bit before the... I don't know what the...
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, early on we had set up both simulations and some sculpted shapes that had a really deep trough because the papers that we looked at on rogue waves indicated that there would be a trough that is almost half as deep as the wave is high preceding the wave. Again, for compositional reasons... that was reduced. There's some of that still in the movie. You can see that there's a bit of, you know, a valley before the mountain of water. But for the most part, we reduced that just because it was confusing in a number of shots. And if you haven't read the paper, then you wouldn't quite know what to do with that. So so in the end, they wanted very much graphically to just have this mountain of water approaching the ship.
And just to finish up, this technology is actually not all just been originated for Poseidon. It's actually sort of fairly in-depth in ILM's pipeline. I understand it was used with, like, the earlier version on the lava in Star Wars in EP3. Is that right?
I believe that it was used to some extent on the lava in Star Wars. It originated with Terminator 3, and very early versions of this were used to run some of the Chrome simulations on the female TX robot, and after that it was used for a single shot in Pirates 2 for a glass of wine that is spilled through the skeleton of a pirate, and Harry Potter 4 used it for a single shot of a ship coming out of water, but nobody had used it on the scale that Poseidon needed to use it really across dozens of shots. The great thing was that once we got over that hump of getting it to work, and there were a number of obstacles. I mean, we really needed to run this entire show 64-bit just to be able to handle the amount of detail that the simulations required and the rendering required. But once we got over that hump, it turned out that the fluid simulations became a really reliable approach, not just for big hero events, but for small events like minor splashes, like doing bow wakes and things like that. So in the end, in a number of shots where we didn't even anticipate in the beginning we would use fluid sims, where we wanted to use much more traditional approaches, it turned out to be really easy to just turn on the fluid sim, have the ship go through the water, and you would get a really good-looking bow wake, for example, and that was really great to see that it got to that level where it was almost intuitive.
I know a lot of the apps you use are proprietary, but could you just walk us through the pipeline? You said it was 64-bit. What after you mentioned some of the shaders, what were you compositing in, and was it a multi-pass render, or was it pretty much handed off from 3D?
So the compositing was done entirely in Shake. We chose to really break up all our renders into lots of lighting passes, both separating out like sources of light and separating out the different kinds of contributions, such as diffuse and reflection and specular and the global illumination, to really give the compositor the as much control in the composite as possible, partially because that's what we were used to work like at ESC with Kim Library, but also because the renders were so expensive with the global illumination and the amount of detail that we had, that it was a great advantage to be able to tweak something like the specular contribution of a particular light or, you know, the fill in the composite rather than having to rerun a really expensive render every time you wanted to make a little tweak. So it turned out really great to have the ability to really change things till the very last minute in the composite frequently without having to do big re-renders.
Was it an OpenEXR 2K pipeline, or were you doing higher than 2K?
We did all of our renders in 2K OpenEXR. The compositing was done at 4K because the client wanted a 4K DI. I believe they're going for an IMAX release as well, so that may have been part of the motivation there. Rendering at 2K and then compositing at 4K.
Wow. Were you responsible for the DI, or was that done separately outside ILM?
That was done separately, as
Because that IMAX version would be something to see, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, look, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. Again, tremendous work and really advancing the art, and I look forward to seeing where the IMAX version is showing so I can really see the fine detail.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, guys, and thanks, Mullen, for taking the time to talk to us this week. Really looking forward to the premiere of that movie this week. If you haven't checked out our online story, we have a lot of great imagery, including a final, I think it's 4K by 2K approximately image with some before and afters. Again, really good stuff in the story that's not necessarily in the podcast. Also want to take a moment to mention our new web venture, FXPhD, which you can find at fxphd.com, with no surprise. We're looking at just doing some online training, kind of filling a void in what we see as real visual effects training from other professionals in the field. It kind of builds upon the tips and tricks that we've done here on Effects Guide, but taking that to a much more structured level. Again, the classes are all going to be taught and by visual effects professionals in the field already. We're really excited about that. Classes start in a week, so head on over to fxphd.com and check that out if you would. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for listening, as always. For Jeff Huser and Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2006 FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide, LLC.